This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
Going downhill, 90 miles an hour. I said hit the brakes, you said hit the accelerator.
President Trump canceled 2 decades of American climate policy. At home, he declared a national emergency to bypass regulations and promote oil and gas. The administration approved contentious pipelines while canceling major wind projects already under construction. Overseas, Trump ordered the military to capture oil tankers on the high seas. How will refossilization of America impact climate change? It is possible to get answers from the world's first carbon accounting platform, Greenly. Alexis Normand is a founder and CEO. Greenly has a report called How U.S. Energy Policy is Impacted with Trump's Return to Office. It includes developments in Greenland and Venezuela. From Paris, Alexis Normand, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hey, how are you? Great to be here. And yes, it's super preoccupying to see the U.S., which traditionally led on decarbonization, take such a step back.
Well, cutting carbon fuel emissions is key in the Paris Agreement to limit dangerous climate change. Now President Trump appears to have thrown out the global climate plan?
Absolutely. I mean, the U.S. is about 13% of global emissions. First problem is the Trump administration is essentially gutting out every institution that helps the U.S. measure its own emissions. And it's essentially downscaling all the programs that help the U.S. actually reduce their emissions, which is, to summarize, essentially switching every source of fossil fuel to electricity and making that electricity greener. So not only can't we measure the progress, but we're making all the different moves to essentially walk back on the progress that was made. And I'd like to add that the U.S. is 13% of global emissions, but if you look historically, the U.S. has been responsible for maybe more like 25% of global emissions emitted throughout, essentially, ever since the Industrial Revolution. So in a sense, it's got to be even more ambitious if it wants to lead the fight around against climate change.
Tell us about new pipelines and drilling leases intended to boost U.S. fossil fuel production.
It's hard to get authorization, and I think there's this pro-business agenda that's pushing the administration to make things easier. But in practice, it's really the price of oil that makes an investment profitable or not. So part of those announcements are more like for television or making the news than is actually increasing the number of investments simply. So I wouldn't link the announcements to actual increase in extraction, which are more related to the price of oil than what the administration has to say.
If the United States gets oil and gas from the previously protected Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska, how much more greenhouse gases could be added to the atmosphere?
In 2025, President Trump reopened the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge for oil and gas exploration. So we estimate that this is opening vast, previously untouched lands, which could lead to an extraction of oil that would generate up to 3.8 billion metric tons of CO2 over the course of several years. Just to put this into perspective, we emit about 50 billion tons of CO2 each year. So we're talking about the equivalent of something like 8 to 10% of global emissions that would be extracted if we basically burned all the fuel in Alaska.
The administration canceled a number of wind energy projects, both onshore and offshore. Talk to us about the greenhouse difference between having that new green energy versus burning oil and gas instead. It creates a gap on both ends, doesn't it?
The way to think about renewable energies is what's the emission intensity of an extra kilowatt hour. Now, typically, if you have a coal plant, it's like 800 grams of CO2 for every kilowatt hour. If you have gas turbine, it's more like 300 grams of CO2. If you have nuclear energy, it's like zero. But if you have a wind turbine, it's like 15 grams of CO2 per kilowatt hour. So if you cancel all the programs, what happens is this energy is going to be consumed more likely by a gas turbine. So you're replacing energy of something like 300-500 grams of CO2 per kilowatt hour, whereas you could have had something essentially 20 times less intensive. So Precise Metrics greenly estimates that the additional emissions are about 550,000 metric tons of CO2 extra that will be emitted as a result of these project cancellations. Now, maybe to give you an even wider perspective, when the Paris agreements were signed about 10 years ago, people thought that, you know, we would like reach a world where the temperature would rise by 5 or 6 degrees Celsius. So essentially making Earth a living hell. And now today we're like, okay, the current trajectory brings us to a world of 2 to 3 degrees extra. So it's a little less life-threatening. And the reason for that inflection in the trajectory is essentially a result of the amazing surge in renewable energy, solar and wind panels. So it's something that has already helped us avoid the worst possible outcome. So when you see individual projects being canceled, it's really disheartening because it's the absolute opposite of what the world needs just to like essentially avoid the future catastrophe for our kids, you know.
So oil and gas in the key U.S. Permian Basin is getting harder and more expensive to get out of the ground. Do you think Trump is going after oil in Venezuela and maybe Greenland out of fears of peak oil in the continental U.S.? That's a bit speculative, but what do you think?
He's certainly the defender of the current energy model that has made, you know, our industrial societies rich. So a lot of people see climate change as essentially a cost, you know, having to pay more for getting the same, right? Because electric cars are more expensive upfront than in ICE internal combustion engine cars, because changing your gas heater in your house, your boiler, is more expensive than, you know, it saves you money versus switching to, say, electric heating and so on. So I think beyond the like economic computation, he's addressing a crowd of people who see the energy transition as a threat to their purchasing power. And he's saying, you don't need to change. We're okay for another 20, 30 years. So people who, I guess, agree with him would tend to think that, you know, I call it denialism. And of course, in the short term, it is improving. It has the potential to improve purchasing power if you essentially draft policies that reduce the price of oil and delays the peak oil. So I think it's all consistent, right? But there is so you essentially have to drill more, get more sources, bring the price down, but at the same time, not too low either, because then your friends from the oil industry don't have the economics to drill, right? I think it's a consistent policy that appeals to both the oil producers and to the oil consumers, right? Especially in America. Why? Because Americans tend to drive a lot more than in a lot of other countries, and the price of oil is like 3 or 4 times cheaper than typically what you have in Europe, right, where people live closer to work, and so it's a smaller part of their expense. So with this, I would say there's an alternative narrative, which is to say peak oil is coming, the cost of drilling is increasing, so you're essentially clinging on to a model that is going to be wiped out because in the end, renewable energy is cheaper, so you're buying time. You're essentially entertaining the illusion that you can keep living with technologies, fossil fuel technologies, that are going to expire, and it's comfortable for now, but what you're really doing is losing out against those that are investing in what I think is the coming model of having cheaper electric cars, cheaper energy sources from wind or solar, cheaper heating because electricity prices, while they are increasing in the short term in the U.S., will end up dropping. So it's not so much about peak oil. I mean, we'll have high fossil fuel machines with prices rising before we hit peak oil, but we'll give up on them because we'll have cheaper electrical machines, so cars, heaters, energy plants, and so on, before, and you're going to lose out on China and perhaps Europe if they invest faster in those new technologies. So that's how I see it.
Right in the news, Donald Trump angered allies in Europe and Scandinavia by demanding total control and ownership over Greenland. Is there an oil or gas connection behind this aggressive policy? What do you think, Alexis?
This whole thing, I think, makes no sense at all from start to finish, if you really want to know what I think. But if you look at it from an energy standpoint, the official arguments are more around, so there's a security argument, but that, you know, I'm less competent on. But if you look at the resource argument, they focus more on the rare earth potential of Greenland, because the thing about rare earth, right, is those minerals that you use for semiconductors, electronic stuff, radars, defense, but actually even more so than to power up your F-32, it's to power up your Tesla, your electric cars, your wind turbines. So the resource potential of Greenland that is actually mentioned by the administration is around rare earth minerals, which doesn't make any sense because you actually need them for the energy transition. So on the one hand, you're denying that climate change is a problem, but on the other hand, you're planning a policy that helps you invest in those resources. The fact that Greenland is interesting for it is not just that they have some, it's also that mining them is such a heavy industrial operation that it essentially destroys the whole ecosystem around it. It's gigantic mines, so actually you have rare earth everywhere, but you need to find places where you don't have any people living, because then you are like essentially destroying the earth for miles and miles away, and Greenland is pretty much empty. So assuming the cold and all wouldn't be a problem, it's a good place to do it. But to finish on the Greenland story, there is also theoretically oil and gas. The reason no one is drilling it is it's because it's just too expensive to drill it. So it's more expensive than shale oil, it's more expensive than what you'd find in Venezuela and so on. But assuming very optimistically from a drilling perspective, of course, that, you know, all this ice melts and that it would become cheaper to drill, well, you have enough oil in Greenland then, theoretically, to drill about so you would be able, essentially, with oil and gas, you'd be able to drill for what would represent about 150 million tons of CO2 per year. That's about like a quarter of France's emission, if you like, to give you an idea. And so in total, you'd be able to drill about 15 billion tons of CO2. And that's just for the oil. But if you add the natural gas, I mean, it's absolutely crazy. You'd be able to collect gas to a point where it would constitute 15,000 billions of tons of CO2. So remember, we emit about 50 billion tons of CO2 as a whole every year on Earth as a result of human activities. But this would be 15,000 total. So essentially, if we drilled and collected all the oil and gas that's present in Greenland, we'd go way overboard into the total climate apocalypse. So, I mean, it makes no sense from start to finish. That's the key takeaway.
It seemed no one was expecting American conflict with Venezuela. Certainly the people on the street weren't looking for that. Were you surprised by Trump's militant focus there?
I I mean, I'm surprised, as anyone else, right? But what surprised me the most was not the ability to remove a person who I don't think anyone finds sympathetic, right? And beyond, you know, the question around the legality with respect to international law and so on. But what surprised me the most is the very open talk about the immediate control over Venezuelan oil. And I think usually, even when that is the primary motive of an intervention, typically you'd try to justify this by perhaps emphasizing on the defense of human rights and democracy and so on, which are, in this case, probably very legitimate reasons. But here it feels like none of this has any importance versus just making U.S. oil companies more profitable, which, you know, it, to me is a little shocking. Not that making profit is shocking, but that you would say this for your companies. Plus, you know, that if you actually end up extracting all this oil and consuming it, in a sense, the embargo had a positive effect on the decarbonization trajectory of the U.S., right? But if they do get it all out of the ground, if they do revamp the Venezuelan industry and they do end up limiting gas and boosting consumption, well, you're essentially doing everything you shouldn't be doing when it comes to reducing your fossil fuel emissions at U.S. level, right? So it's really to make this the primary motive and narrative is essentially going completely the opposite direction of, say, what Europe has formalized around the Green Deal, which is all about what do we do to reduce oil emissions and have electric cars and so on. So, I mean, it's frank, it's direct, it says what it is, but it's the opposite of what should be done, in my view. From the oil perspective, I'm not talking about the democratic interventionism, which, you know, people can debate.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Now, despite big climate talk and some green initiatives, the administration of Joe Biden was also for drill, baby, drill. Biden approved thousands of new oil and gas projects, mostly fracking on public lands. In fact, your report finds Trump's team has fewer drilling permits per month than Biden did. So why focus on Trump?
Yeah, I think that's a fair point, right? And in practice, the price of oil, as I said, determines more the space at which the oil and gas industry starts to drill, and the administration is generally quite lenient. There is a fundamental difference, nonetheless, is that when you drill oil, you pump a number of gallons every day, and it's always to answer a very short-term need because everything you pump out is like basically consumed immediately. There's really little stock of oil versus the consumption in relative proportion. So the Biden administration like eases short-term consumption, but what it did in parallel is that it created a framework for investing over the long term on renewable energies through the so-called IRA. And so that was essentially a $300 billion plus investment in making renewable energies more affordable, producing wind farms, solar, providing subsidies to both the construction and the projects and the electricity itself and so on, all of which is being reversed. So any U.S. administration will allow a ton of, you know, gas and oil drilling, but not all of them invest in long-term replacement because there's this so-called ballistic effect, right? Everything we do in this space will materialize when the projects come out. And actually, now you're starting to see some of these projects come out, right, where there was a commitment from the U.S. administration to help finance this stuff. So you have the famous Ørsted wind farms across New England, and they were, as you know, probably canceled when 90% of the projects were actually finished. And so the Trump administration took that decision. But what happens is you do have to enforce contracts if you in a country that respects rule of law. So a judge canceled the cancellation, and these projects went through. And the wind farms are going to happen and so on. And at the end, it's an economic decision. It's not a political one, but you do see both administrations using the argument for different political directions, for sure.
After natural gas sanctions against Russia, Europe scrambled to build massive liquefied gas import terminals. I think Germany was going to build 8 of them. Canada built new export facilities. The U.S., from Alaska to Louisiana, hopes to profit from the LNG boom. How is this going to affect climate change, the rush to LNG?
It's a great point. And by the way, the so-called Turnberry Agreement, where Europe and the U.S. struck a deal to limit tariff increases to something like 15% for European goods to flow into the U.S., also had an LNG component, where Europe made a soft commitment to essentially buy a lot of LNG gas from the U.S. to essentially compensate for the gas that it's not buying from Russia. And if the volume commitments were to essentially be upheld, so if Europe is actually to buy all the LNG gas from the U.S. that it said it would totally derail the Green Deal commitments that the EU has formalized. And here I'll remind people that Europe has committed to reduce its emissions by 90% by 2040. And so if it ends up buying all the LNG gas that it said it would in the so-called Turnberry Agreement, then this objective is essentially very, very compromised.
So what did the Trump administration gain by declaring a national energy emergency? I don't think a lot of the public even realized he did that. And was there any emergency?
Well, let's take a few examples when you had emergencies, right? If you remember the oil shocks of first 1973 and then 1979 when the OPEC, which is the organization of oil-producing countries, essentially declared an embargo and quotas, you essentially had the price of oil that was multiplied first by 3, then by 5, and in the end by something like 10. And so because our economies were extremely dependent on a certain price point for oil, it pushed the whole Western world and beyond, actually, into recession. So this is what I called an emergency, because people are losing their jobs, because the GDP is decreasing, et cetera, et cetera. Now, when Trump took power, no such thing was happening, right? The price of oil is relatively low by modern standards. There's actually a slight overproduction, right? So, which he himself is probably making worse. So, I mean, there's a positive outcome to this, which is oil prices decrease. So the positive outcome from the consumer perspective, right, is to pay less for driving your car. But, I can't see the emergency. I mean, it's more, I think, a good storytelling talent that he has to make something critical, to create a crisis when there isn't, and to use that so-called crisis to essentially grab power that you wouldn't otherwise have to do things otherwise. So that's my perspective on it. But it has given him what's so-called executive might to cancel a lot of renewable energy projects and so on. So it's a good excuse for pushing his agenda. You can't, you have to give it to him. He knows how to grab power.
Despite some gloom about America, your report still offers policy amendments that could help renewable energy, and that's what your company Greenly does. You offer some solutions. What could the Trump administration do?
First of all, at the end, something everybody respects is just what the market, what market solutions have to offer. So if renewable energy ends up becoming cheaper. I mean, I don't think it stops being a political problem. It's no longer ideology. The market does it, and you can say anything you want about decarbonization or climate change. No one cares. People just see prices being lowered. And that's why a lot of this business here is to entertain the crowds, right? If the market forces are put into action to favor the energy transition, then it's essentially game over. And that has basically happened already for renewables, perhaps not yet for wind farms because the initial investment is high versus, you know, the rest. So there are a number of policies that the Trump administration can take under the pro-business agenda, which are actually favorable to the energy transition, but don't need to be branded as such, right? And so that's just furthering the reduction of energy costs through cheaper technologies with lower capex, and that's something called solar panels or wind farms. Now, the other thing is the administration doesn't necessarily need to, consistent with that vision of just lowering energy costs, it doesn't need to cancel all the projects, especially if the contracts have already been signed and then you don't want this to be challenged. You can do another thing, and that's also an interesting development. I'm sure you've noticed that AI has been a very, very big topic. It's driving economic growth in the U.S., but it's also driving a massive surge in energy consumption to the point where if you have to feed all those data centers which are projected to come out of the ground, there's going to be a trade-off between powering these data centers and powering your home or your car or something. And so you have serious risks of blackouts. So essentially the AI boom could stall if there isn't an energy boom. And so the way to do this is you have to produce more energy and produce more electricity. So right now what's happening is they're facilitating the opening of new gas turbines and so on. The businesses of people selling gas turbines for new energy plants has never been better. But the companies building the data centers, Google, Microsoft, and so on, they have a very clear decarbonization agenda. They sell to Europe. They're not just submissive to the Trump administration. They hold on to these commitments. And so essentially they're thinking about replacing the gas turbines by nuclear energy. And they're even investing for some of them into fusion energy as something that would go hand in hand with the data center revolution. So essentially, to go back to your question, if I'm the Trump administration, and I'm probably not going to boast about furthering the energy transition, but I might say that I'm pushing the AI revolution, in which case to solve that energy problem, I can facilitate the launch of new nuclear energy or fusion energy projects. The drawback of that is these projects take longer to activate than solar panels, right? But they are clean energies, and hopefully they get to a price point which is lower than the fossil fuel alternatives. And so if that happens, you know, whatever the narrative, you've made a great progress into the energy transition. I might add to finish, there's what the Trump administration could do, but then there's what a pro-climate administration could do, right? Which is quite different, because then it makes things a little easier if you can actually say what you're doing, which is to actively draft policies to reduce emissions and not hide it while you're doing it. Then it's things like essentially furthering the logic of the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act. So you want to support, of course, more tax incentives for clean energy. You want perhaps more carbon capture and storage to reduce the emissions of high energy intensity industrial activities, incentives for clean energy jobs. A big, big thing is grid modernization. So the U.S., as you certainly know, has like 16 or different big, big utilities. It has like four or five grids. I can't remember exactly. So the electricity is not connected, and so it's hard to push electricity from one place to another. And since the whole energy transition is about electrifying everything and then making that energy clean, well, you have to have electrons flowing from one place of the country to another. And right now, a solar panel project in, say, California does not send electrons to Virginia, okay? The grids are siloed. So that needs to be fixed. That's a lot of investment. Those are jobs.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Alex is back with Greenly CEO Alex Inmorn talking about backward directions in American energy.
Well, certainly this large coordinated series of climate damaging action, you know, Venezuela, all that, it's not coming just from the brain of Donald Trump alone. He has no direct experience in the oil and gas industry. Is there a grand plan? And if so, who is behind it?
Yeah, look, I mean, with this administration, you don't need to be a conspiracy theory aficionado, so to speak, to see that he's essentially rolling out the policy of the oil and gas industry, and he's not hiding from it, you know, he's very clear, so at least it has the merit of honesty. But to me, you know, it kind of makes me think of like previous industrial revolutions where you have one system dying, in this case, oil and gas, and another emerging, which is, you know, the electric car, the renewable energy. So you kind of already know that, you know, the how the battle will unfold, but will it take 10 years or 50? You know, that's not very clear. And it's not the first time in recent history that we've seen these shifts. And that was typically the case at the end of the 19th century when public lighting was with gas and we shifted to electricity. And then you had folks like Edison and, you know, Westinghouse. They were fighting around technologies like direct current or alternative current. And so everybody knew that alternative current was much better than continuous current. And Edison knew that, but he had bet on the first technology. And so what he did is he lobbied very hard to make sure his investments would break even and that he could keep selling an inferior technology as long as he could. And that's when he hired lobbyists, and he hired a guy who had a brilliant idea, which was to say that alternative current was super dangerous because that's what you use for the electric chair. And so everybody was like, ah, this stuff kills you. And it bought him a couple years. But in the end, you know, the superior technology wins. So to me, the whole thing we're talking about is probably at a larger scale, but, you know, electrifying cities in the 19th century was also a big thing, and you had to choose which technology. So you have an industry that is still very powerful, but everybody knows it's going to stop, and especially the oil and gas executives. They know it, but they would like to keep the party going for another 20 or 30 years if they can. Personally, I think we don't have the luxury of waiting that long. But right now, those who are pushing this agenda are apparently in power, so we have to keep fighting, I guess.
You run a unique kind of company, at least from an American point of view. Briefly, who founded Greenly, and what does it do?
Yeah, so we play our part very simply. We don't really do politics, but your questions led me to I guess, a few statements. But essentially, Greenly makes carbon accounting simple and intuitive. So carbon accounting is the act of measuring a company's emission. And, you know, objectively, scientifically, we make it easy because we fast-track the collection of a company's data to translate all of this into CO2 emissions. So your spend data, your product purchase data, your electricity consumption data, your logistics data, the usage of your products, your machines, your freight, your air transport, your travel, your employee, all of that stuff. So it's a lot of data. It's basically every data a company has that corresponds to some energy usage. We make the data collection of this easy by essentially connecting to every software and information source of a company. We automatically structure this data, and then we analyze it to essentially assign the correct carbon weight, we call them emission factors, to every line item. And then we essentially produce a kind of balance sheet, a carbon accounting report along regulated categories, and we auto-generate the emissions analysis. And then once you're there, once you know your emissions, once you start tracking it year over year, we help you formalize a decarbonization strategy by comparing you against benchmarks, by listing action plans, by listing alternative suppliers that you could use to essentially say, okay, what does it look like for my company to reduce my emissions year over year, perhaps along a standardized trajectory that is in line with the Paris Agreement and the so-called pathway to net zero by 2050. So this is what we do with the software. It used to be in the old world very complex, very expensive. You'd have to hire consultants who do all this manually. We reduce the cost drastically. We increase the speed. We make most of the pain go away. And what that allows you to do is commit your company on a net zero trajectory. Don't get me wrong. Companies don't do this because, you know, they want to save the world. They do this because usually they have a customer who's made a commitment. It could be a big company, it could be a hospital, it could be a public organization. And so if they want to win the deal, if they want to win an RFP, everything else being equal, price, service, etc., they get bonus points or they get a right to play because they are a serious company and they have a decarbonization trajectory. That might sound wild to the average user, but a quarter of our business is in the U.S., so we're essentially selling to U.S. companies who are manufacturing products, and they need to sell to big U.S. companies, big European companies, and showing the carbon footprint of their product, of their organization, is essentially the right to play. And I think that says something bigger about the energy transition. It's about policy, it's about governments, it's about laws, but it's also about companies setting targets and embedding those requirements into their procurement, into their supply chain. And that's how you have this trickle-down effect where companies which are the biggest emitters actually end up reducing their emissions. And so we're a piece of that, basically.
From the international carbon accounting company Greenlee, we've been speaking with CEO Alexis Normand, and you can find that company at greenlee.earth. Alexis, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for your great questions, and I hope this was interesting to our listeners.
Radio EcoShock.
Trump and his backers are engaged in a transcontinental war against climate by opening up protected Arctic lands to oil and gas drilling, by enabling mass gas pipelines, through militarism to increase Venezuelan heavy oil, his threats to take Greenland's untapped oil and gas, and meanwhile, he's killing off clean energy, wind and solar, and forcing continued fossil burning. He's ordered coal-burning plants to stay open past their lifetimes. This all adds up to a strike against climate hopes and the futures of our children and all species. Much of this fossil pooch is detailed in the new Greenlee report, how U.S. energy policy is impacted with Trump's return to office. We don't know if there is a single plan, and if so, who the planners are. Certainly, this large, coordinated series of actions is not coming from the brain of Donald Trump. In his first presidency, Trump made the CEO of ExxonMobil his Secretary of State from 2017 to 2018. Some initiatives, like the pipelines, started in that period with Rex Tillerson. But the second Trump administration plan, if you call it that, it's so much broader. It includes military capture of the oil reserves of other countries, like Venezuela and Greenland so far. His threats to make Canada an American state may also be aimed at taking over billions of barrels of oil reserves in the Alberta oil sands. And in fact, the U.S. government has met with would-be separatists in Alberta. That is strange because American companies develop most of the tar sands with hefty government subsidies from the government of Canada. They could have owned more and with amazingly low royalties, and they don't need an invasion. How should we see Trump's oil geopolitics? Who is behind it? Rather than a single mastermind, this may be a network project. Fossil fuel-aligned political appointees, national security hawks, corporate lobbyists, and sympathetic think tanks work together to convert Trump's impulses into multi-decade leasing plans, Arctic opening strategies, and leverage over foreign oil systems. Trump's role is lead actor. He provides political cover and distraction. The operational vision, the maps, lease calendars, legal arguments, diplomatic probes, talk of military leverage, all that comes from an ecosystem of actors whose careers and ideologies are tied to expanding U.S. control over hydrocarbons and critical resources and over other people. What does AI say? Perplexity suggests there is no single mastermind, but a kind of fossil ecological network of actors with similar goals. This may be called an actor network, using actor network theory called ANT. In ANT, an apparently single actor is actually a heterogeneous network of many entities acting together. Because we are inside this whole system, we never capture reality in ideas. ANT theory is a deep rabbit hole. It is probably worth your time, if only as brain-stretching exercise. Check it out. The word conspiracy appeals to so many people. In a December article, David Olivier Deleth finds the secretive cabal of U.S. polluters that is rewriting the EU's human rights and climate law. He writes, leaked documents reveal how a secretive alliance of 11 companies, including Chevron, ExxonMobil, and Koch, has worked together under the guise of a competitiveness roundtable. But conspiracy only covers part of the phenomenon. These fossil actors may not have met, they may not have formed any overt agreement as required under the law, or even know some of the other players. They all proceed toward the same goals with ruthless disregard for long-term climate consequences and killing if needed. Personally, I think this is much bigger than conspiracy. You and I, innocently filling our gas tanks at the station, are in on the game. Karl Marx thought those at the top of capitalism were just as deluded as those at the bottom. Surely there must be somebody whispering in Trump's ear. He seems not coherent or bright enough to develop all this on his own. But it doesn't have to be one person. A series of people, all aligned in their views and goals, have placed ideas in his head which he adopts as his own. He has a history of that. That is the backstory of Greenland. Years ago, a cosmetics billionaire put the idea in Trump's mind to take Greenland for America. Perhaps he sees this as his legacy, adding land to America, like the Louisiana Purchase, like Poland to Germany. The oil and gas companies just want to drill the Arctic. This may be the last frontier up for grabs. Hard-nosed executives can tell themselves the world needs more energy to keep going, despite a few, you know, climate challenges. And that delusion fills the halls of power in so many countries. Call it what you will. The freight train of calamitous climate shift thunders toward us. It is helped by leaders and institutions and banks. Do you think we will stop it? Will we jump aside just in time, or what? Trump tries to bring the 19th century fossil fuels back to life. Wall Street takes our investments and savings into wrecking that future. But some countries struggle to do better. China adds more renewables every year than the rest of the world combined. Australian solar panels on homes add so much power. The utilities give electricity free just for parts of the day. No charge for a charge. In our hearts, in most people, even in America, according to the polls, we hope for the pendulum of emissions will swing the other way. Year by year, we hope to add so much green energy that coal mines will close and unnatural gas becomes rare in homes. But how will this green vision work? A new study finds there are tipping points in America's fossil fuel system. If the minimum levels of use are not met, and these are pretty high for climate control, large amounts of the system become unviable and collapse, and that's messy. For example, oil refineries are not all the same. They are built specifically to produce certain products and not others. If one specialized refinery closes, a whole ecosystem of pipelines, factories, and products could go down with it. Or another problem, who pays for gas when there are only a few customers left, but pipelines cost hundreds of millions to maintain? The argument goes, we need a plan for design decline of fossil fuels. Shutting down Higgly Piggly is just not as easy as we think. The press release for this science paper says, quote, according to Lappin and Grubert, this neglect is risky because such systems may fail once they fall below a minimum viable scale, the point at which their physical, financial, and managerial foundations can no longer operate as expected, triggering service collapses, safety hazards, economic shocks, and environmental harm. This could erode public trust in the energy transition itself. Minimum viable scales may be much larger and closer than commonly recognized, say the authors, end quote from Science. The new paper is called Fossil Energy Minimum Viable Scale. The authors are Joshua Lappin and Emily Grubert, both from Notre Dame University. This was published January 29, 2026 in the journal Science. Most of us won't read this report because it is guarded by a paywall. To be honest, the paper seems aimed at nebulous policymakers and academics in the field rather than you and I. We need to read between the lines and imagine bad scenarios as the old fossil feeding tubes close down. Josh and Emily appeared on a podcast from Science hosted by Sarah Crespi. Let's listen to a couple of clips.
The other thing I wanted to ask about is this kind of main idea that you focus on in your paper. There's a lot of modeling being done on scaling up and scaling down these systems, but these models seem to be missing what you call minimum viable scale as a factor in understanding how these drawdowns will work.
Minimum viable scale is the category that we've offered here to unite a variety of different limits that emerge in complex networked systems that can prevent them from shrinking linearly or manageably past a certain point.
Something is shrinking in a predictable way, and then it gets to a certain point and it's no longer possible. It's not going to be available for whatever reason. Let's get into some specifics, some examples of this.
We've broken minimum viable scale down into a set of types. We talk about physical minimum viable scale, which has to do with throughput and operational limits that are actually design properties or emergent operational properties of the physical systems themselves. We talk about economic minimum viable scale, which has to do with the way that we finance infrastructure, and we finance in particular its maintenance and operations over longer periods of time. And then we also talk about managerial minimum viable scale, where we identify types of constraint that emerge because of either operational cultures or decision-making boundaries. The big example there that we think will be familiar to people but isn't often considered in the context of energy system planning and climate policy is antitrust. It's actually illegal in many cases for the operators of big fossil fuel assets to coordinate with each other.
To make it a little bit more concrete for people, like you talk about coal mines and how a coal mine is supplying locally to electricity generating plants. And if a bunch of them go offline suddenly because the demand is down, people are switching over to renewables, the mine might close. But then that means that mine, which makes coal that it can't be shipped all around the world, it has to be used like by a plant designed to use it, that might suddenly shut down. And there's this back and forth, and having them cooperate, communicate is not necessarily in their best interest today. But as things go further, as things decline in an unpredictable way, either on the mining side or the generation side, you're going to have to be more coordinated
I'm super glad you bring up that example, actually. So a lot of people don't know this, but there's like 10-ish big mines in Wyoming that supply about half of the country's coal. And when we went to look into, just like what you're saying, how many generators would actually have to shut down to make it so that we don't think that those mines could continue to operate. And for people that have been out to northeastern Wyoming, they're enormous. The biggest of those mines is about 8 miles across. But what we found there is that it's actually a shockingly small number of generators that we need to close to change the demand for that mine so much year over year that it might not stay open. And so that's basically where we're getting at this minimum viable scale thing.
And you talked before about these schedules, like there are all these decision points in these giant pieces of infrastructure where they're like, we need to redo our plant. We need to clean up these pipes. We need to invest money in them. And if you know 5-10 years from now, you're not going to be using any of this, why would you do that?
Exactly. It's really expensive. Like if you look into maybe spending $100 million to keep a plant open that might need to shut down in 2 years anyway, like it's really, really noticeable that you stop investing in those ways, which means also back to this point about why minimum viable scale is a way to identify risks, I think there are a bunch of issues where we're essentially encouraging the system to run to failure.
We're just decreasing demand without kind of managing supply in a way that doesn't just crash. Is that kind of what you're getting at?
Part of it, yeah. And I think one of the other things that we look at is just that historically speaking, we have seen that even when you do have these big breakthroughs with renewables, which I don't want to, you know, imply that that's not a big deal, but we haven't necessarily seen a corresponding set of closures that imply to us that there's actually a replacement going on.
This is really interesting from the risk side where you're talking about the backlash that you could face if we do see these spikes in the price of fossil fuels as renewables kind of ramp up. You know, that's also going to be industry clinging to life.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And you're taking a very, very powerful industry with a relatively small number of assets, which in some ways confers maybe more political power than you see with something where you have very, very modular systems that can be built in lots of places, which is a huge advantage for renewables. But when you've got like a fossil system that is basically providing half of the funding for a town's K-12 education without a plan where you're explaining how that thing is going to turn off, and maybe it's been there for 100 years, like they're already at end of life in a lot of cases, which is a nice thing about the fact that the US's infrastructure is old, but without a plan for what happens next, it's probably not going to try to go offline on its own.
I thought the detail in this paper, I wish we could go into all of it. I really liked all your examples because it really does infiltrate our lives in 1,000 different ways. And to imagine it all disappearing, like the pipelines that people fight about, once you turn off some of those, they degrade and everybody who's left using them is going to be paying more and more. And so it's definitely a slow motion disaster if nothing is done.
One of the things that we really think is important to kind of talk about within the modeling community too, though, is that oftentimes the way that our models are set up and the way that many of us are trained is to think about it mostly in cost terms as sort of a proxy for all of these other things. And I think one of the big points that Josh and I make is that cost is one of these issues. This is also a massive unexamined safety problem because the fundamental underlying conditions are changing. And it's also, like Josh mentioned earlier, a huge issue where you might just fail to have access to certain services. So it's not just cost, it's also these safety and access questions.
It's also the case that in some cases, depending on the failure mode here, failure can be irreversible. And what we really don't want is to find ourselves in a situation where a system reaches its minimum viable scale and breaks in a way that makes it much, much harder to regain that energy supply capacity going forward.
I can't imagine spinning back up a petroleum refinery, for example.
Right.
Very small lapses in maintenance can cause immensely expensive and slow repair processes at refineries. This is something that refinery operators are already aware of, that refinery workers are constantly wrangling with refinery management about. And as margins get thinner, as more competitive pressure between remaining refineries gets introduced, the temptation to cut back on maintenance schedules grows, and that introduces new risks for workers and also new risks that these assets are going to be suddenly unavailable for long periods of time.
What kind of scale should we be thinking about here? You know, I started with global increase in renewable use, but mostly you've talked about the U.S. and smaller units like either industries or different types of generation. Is this something that needs to be applied all the way up and down the scale?
But there's another set of concerns about actually whether energy services will be available at all for any price under some circumstances. This looks different in different fossil systems, but we think it's actually pretty intuitive. The one we like to talk about in these circumstances most, because almost everyone interacts with it on a daily and a weekly basis is the gas station. We are all dependent not just on the existence of a gas station, but the existence of an entire network of gas stations.
If you switch to an electric car maybe 5 years ago, you're going to have trouble driving across the U.S. I had friends who tried it and who were like, yeah, there were a few stumbling blocks. The network wasn't there. So imagine now that's ramping up. And then this gasoline supply is not ramping down in an equal and well-distributed way. It's patchy, maybe expensive or not there at all in parts of the country.
Oh, absolutely. As things start to decline, one of the ways that our current system sort of encourages something to stay open or not to stay open is whether it's profitable. And one of the big arguments that we make is that as you get to the point where some of these systems aren't expecting to be in a growth scenario anymore, you can't rely on demand being there for a long time. The facilities that remain profitable aren't necessarily the ones that you need to provide service continuity. And so this also points to we need to plan this.
That was a clip from a podcast from Science Magazine. It was hosted by Sarah Crespi. Guests were Joshua Lappin and Emily Grubert. Find the full podcast free at science.org/podcasts.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
Is it likely we will be able to plan any of this, like a design for the decline of fossil power? It seems more likely international oil shocks or a major depression happening during all kinds of climate disasters. It just knocks parts of the system offline with no plans or ability to control it. And fossil fuel profiteers may use this study to call for a cautious approach or even government subsidies because of the threat of losing service, justifying more decades of dependence. This is a slippery slope, and the authors know it. It is not as though we have more years to develop cautious plans. Climate disasters are already here. All of this goes back to managed decline that peak oil folks worked on for years. Prior to 2010, we may have had time for managed decline. Now there's only time for emergency withdrawal, if there's any time at all, to avoid climate disaster. This discussion is just not new. Most of it developed in Europe years ago, for example. And what lessons can we learn from there? What is happening to fossil infrastructure in China as it rapidly builds out renewables? As far as I can tell, these two authors consider only America with no input from lessons learned already in Europe or China or elsewhere. The authors call for nationalization of the energy grid. Is this just another example of private parties taking the profits and then getting buyouts from the public as their market collapses? The plan is to make obscene amounts of money until collapse and then good luck. The American system is planning on collapse and energy chaos. Thank you for your attention to this matter. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about this messy world.
What's that you see? Nothing.